This episode contains some mild swearing.
Young people. How are young people under 25 coping with the climate emergency? How do they feel about their futures, starting families or going to university? And what matters more, having a good job or doing everything they can to save society from collapsing? In this series of Tipping Points, I speak with young people who have taken extreme measures to address the greatest challenge humanity has ever faced. Phoebe Plummer, one of the young activists from Just Stop Oil, became famous after throwing soup at the Sunflowers painting in London. Her phrase, "What's worth more, art or life?" echoed around the world's newspapers and helped to make the conversation around the climate crisis develop. But at the age of 21, Phoebe has sacrificed plenty to achieve this, including fractious relationships with family and friends and even spending time in prison without conviction. This is the first part of a two-part interview with Phoebe, where we talk about her experience in prison, why young people would work for oil companies, and how her family dynamics have been strained by her actions. Phoebe's with me at the Grantham Institute at Imperial College London for an in-person interview with her ankle tag to talk about the role of young people in the climate crisis. Firstly, could you outline your understanding of the variety of feelings of young people around the climate crisis?
We're starting to see the effects of the climate crisis here, but we're not living the worst realities of it in the way that they are in the global south. You know, here we're still reporting on not being able to ski because the snow's melting. It's like, God, is that really what you're worried about when people are dying and losing their homes and not being able to eat? I don't know anyone personally that well that's affected, but the university I go to is very international. And after the soup action, what we're affectionately calling Soupageddon, a lot of people in my university accommodation came up to me and thanked me. One of the most emotional moments I had, it was the first night that I'd come back to my student accommodation, and I got a lot of hate online. I'd gotten quite a lot of personal hate, people that I knew that I thought were my friends, who then decided that they hated me. And two people came up who were from Pakistan and have family who still live in Pakistan, and came up and thanked me and started crying, thanking me for what I do, raising awareness for the climate crisis. It was a few months ago, so it was very recently after the massive floods in Pakistan when 33 million people were displaced. And those two people that came up to me and said that completely overweighed every message of hate, everything else, seeing so personally the people that are affected by the climate crisis and the people who you're trying to raise awareness for what they're going to. It meant so much.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine that was a pretty heartfelt exchange. Which university are you going to at the moment?
The School of Oriental and African Studies, SOAS, in London. I do social anthropology, and I'm in my first year, although I can't pretend that I dedicate the amount of time to it that I should do. I wish that when I sat in university lectures, that felt like the most important thing. I wish I was worrying about the results of my latest essay, not the survival of the human race. It's something that I feel has been robbed from me as a young person slightly, putting my all and all the interest and passion I have for my subject into my university degree. But I spent my university freshers' term in prison. Like, it's not where my priorities lie, and it's faced with the hard reality of the scientific facts. It's not where I think my priorities should lie right now.
Tell me more about your experience in prison. So what happened? How did you end up there, and what was your experience there like?
So I spent 28 days on remand in HMP Bronzefield. It was following the M25 gantries actions. I think I maybe had a slightly warped perception of prison. It wasn't easy. But my experience there was very doable. It was very manageable. I was there with other people who had taken action on the M25. So I had a community around me, support. I was sharing a room with somebody else from Just Stop Oil. And we very much kept each other's morale up, kept each other in good spirits. And I don't think I would have coped without them. And I think maybe the biggest thing, my biggest power in there was knowing I was in there for the right reasons. You're not in there pondering your crimes and the ways you've gone wrong. You're in there because you know you've done the morally right thing.
What exchanges did you have with fellow inmates? What did they say to you, or what did they hear from you that made them think differently?
It's quite funny. I could tell instantly who watched the news and who didn't in prison by if they recognised me in a way that other Just Stop Oil people maybe didn't have. My pink hair is quite recognisable. It was nice in prison because there's the space and the time to have the conversations about why you're there. I am 21 and look even younger, so people were quite shocked that I was in prison, which I think is the right response. I'm shocked that at 21 I felt the step I needed to take was to go to prison. That's insane to me. But it gave the time and the space to talk about why we do these things, why we block roads or block the M25 or throw soup on paintings.
Were you asked any questions where they challenged you?
Yes. There was one woman who had a visit that she had planned cancelled because of the M25 actions, and her son, who's a few months old, couldn't come to see her. And that was hard to hear. In some ways, it was something I was prepared for because we know that we're causing disruption. We know that we are disrupting people who aren't the ones causing the climate crisis. And of course, it's frustrating when we do that. But it was also really nice in prison to have the time and the space to sit down with her and say, yes, you are so right to be angry at us for that. You are so right to feel grief about that. When you're in prison, a visit once a week is one of the main things you look forward to. To have the time to emotionally connect with the grief and anger she feels, but also have the time to say, it's wrong that you had to go through that and that you were personally affected, but we have to disrupt business as usual because it is uncomfortable facing the harsh realities of the climate crisis. It's uncomfortable looking straight in the eyes of mass famine and mass displacement of people. But we have to, because we're looking right at the biggest crisis humanity has ever faced. And if we carry on with business as usual, that's what's going to kill us. It's what's is risking the lives of me and my generation. It's what's killing people in the global south right now.
Could you explain to people listening how people can be put in prison for months without being charged or convicted of a crime, which is known in the UK as being held on remand, for peaceful protests designed to raise awareness and force action on the climate crisis?
I mean, it's a bit insane to me too. You know, I'm not a criminal. I'm a scared kid trying to fight for my future. I was prepared for it though, because going into this, we always knew backlash would be part of getting closer to meeting our demand. I took a lot of inspiration from the history of other movements of social change, because a lot of my heroes have been to prison. And I say heroes in that I'm able to exist today because of what they did. I'm a queer and born female, so the reason I'm able to vote, go to university, hopefully someday will marry the woman I love, is because of people who have made the same sacrifices that I'm willing to make. But it does seem crazy to me. You know, I was held on remand too. I haven't been convicted of anything. And yet I spent a month in prison and I'm facing more prison time for other cases. I think maybe the short answer is that the law isn't always what's morally right. I think we're seeing very pertinent examples of that around the world, like in Iran, where women are being sentenced to prison or physically attacked, violently hurt, because they're standing up for the rights of women. and there. That's not what the law dictates. The law isn't always ethical, always moral. And when you are looking straight at unjust laws, I think we have a moral responsibility to do something about that. And that's why I'm willing to risk prison time and arrest.
Why do you think that you have felt so strongly when so many other 21-year-olds seem maybe apathetic or even angry about what you've done? Why is there such a skew in the proportion of people in your age group who are activists and the people who are complicit with this broken system?
There's a big difference between intellectually knowing that the climate crisis is a real thing and a real threat and fully connecting with it emotionally. And I had a maybe a changing point in my activism between intellectualizing it and going, look, there is this crisis. I know that it's happening. I know that it's serious. And that's when I made, you know, a lot of the individual changes that a lot of people make, going vegan, stopping buying anything firsthand, stopping flying. But then there was another moment where I fully opened up emotionally to it and went, this is my future. I felt all the grief and the rage that are actually very rational responses to what's going on. And once I'd connected to that, once I allowed myself to feel the terror, because it is terrifying as a young person. I'm so scared every day. And once I had allowed myself to feel that, I knew that just those individual changes wasn't enough. I knew I had to do everything in my power, because I can't just sit back and watch the destruction of everything I know and love. And I think particularly a barrier for people my age in getting involved in activism is ironically a fear of the future, because that's why I take part in direct action, is because I'm so scared for my future. But it would be naive for me to turn around and say I have no worries about having a criminal record, about having been to prison. It's a big step to take. But for me, I had a flip in my brain where I thought all of these plans and hopes and aspirations I have for my future, for a career, for a family, they don't exist unless I fight for a future in which they're possible. Right now, the only future I see for myself is one of mass famine and constant drought and wildfires and floods and societal collapse. There's no career on that kind of planet. There's no having a family on that kind of planet. So direct action is the best way I can secure myself a future, not with a university degree, as it should be.
We're at Imperial College now. There are many people here who are aspiring to work for oil and gas companies. Why are they there in those recruitment talks? Is it because they want to destroy the world? No. Is it because they think that that's the best way to pay off their student fees? Possibly. Is it because they are unaware of the scale of the urgency of the changes that need to be made? Possibly. Have they been brainwashed by the greenwash of these companies? Possibly. What reflections do you think you have for fellow 20, 21, 22-year-olds aspiring to work for the most destructive industries that exist today?
I think, unfortunately, we're not properly educated about how serious this is. I did a talk for Just Stop Oil about a month ago, and there was a geography teacher there, and he teaches GCSE and A-level geography. And he said that in his GCSE classes, he had to teach the pros and cons of climate change. And my jaw dropped. This isn't a pros and cons situation. It's horrible that it's taken into our own hands to educate ourselves. And the education system is responsible for that. The media is responsible for that. Because for so long, I knew about a climate crisis. I think particularly people my age, we're brought up knowing about this looming crisis, but we're not told what it looks like. And that for me was another real tipping point was when I didn't just hear about a crisis, but I was told what it would look like and what it would look like in my lifetime. And it's terrifying when you do that. Absolutely terrifying. But it has been left into our own hands to go out and educate ourselves. So I think maybe a lot of the people going into these industries are naive about the destruction it's really doing and aren't informed and not through any fault of their own.
How has it been when you've felt pushback against your actions? How has that materialized in relationships that you have with your friends and family?
My family relationships have been put under the biggest strain, probably. My family have struggled to deal with it, which I think initially I felt quite angry about. But I've come to a level of understanding that I'm asking them to deal with something pretty big, to accept the fact that I've gone to prison. It's not something they ever thought their child would do. So I have a bit more compassion with the strain it's put on them now. It's still made my family relationships quite fractious, though. My dad is a climate denier, which makes it very hard to even start having the conversations about what I do. One of my brothers told me I wasn't his sister anymore and that he wanted nothing more to do with me and that he was quote-unquote beyond disgusted and ashamed by me. And that's hard. I can't pretend that it's not. But especially taking the step of being willing to go to prison, it's opened up the need to have these conversations about why I do what I do. Going to prison was not a decision I made lightly. I knew I was risking it, taking the M25 actions. And that's not something you go into without a lot of thought about why this is such a necessary step. And my family, not all of them, but a lot of them at least, saw that and saw that even if they don't agree with what I do, we need to be having those conversations about why, because that is so important. And in wider family relationships and friendships, it's hard because I often feel like I'm shouting at a brick wall. People who just don't want to wake up to how serious the future we're facing is, feeling like you're not getting through. It can feel very alienating, especially with people my own age, because it is our futures at stake. My generation doesn't have the luxury of sitting on the sidelines anymore. So when I've invited friends to talks I do or told them why I take action, And they listen and they go, oh, it's really great what you're doing, but then they don't take action. I find it really hard to relate because it's so serious what we're facing. And it's going to impact me and my friends so much. I don't understand how they can hear all these things and carry on with their everyday lives, how they can continue sitting in university lectures saying that getting a degree is the most important thing when last year, Sir David King said we have 3 to 4 years to determine the future of humanity. Gives us 2 to 3 years now, the length of my university degree. I can't get a degree and then focus on this. This is now. We need to make change now. And one of the things that upsets me the most is when people tell me that they admire my passion or my dedication. It's like, this isn't a passion. This isn't a hobby. There's a lot of joy in the movement, but it's not fun going to prison and going out and getting arrested. I don't do this because of passion. I do this for survival.
I wonder if having this difference in understanding and reaction. Has that helped you to empathise with a group of society who do deny that carbon emissions are a problem and that their fate of civilization is in the balance? Has it helped you to kind of relate to that group of society and understand why they might be feeling that way?
It certainly helped me find better ways to talk to people who deny the science about what's going on. I think before putting in so much effort to be able to maintain a relationship with my dad, I initially would have gotten angry and completely written off where they're coming from, because it is wrong to deny the science. I don't think that the government should listen to what a 21-year-old has to say about the climate crisis and how we avoid catastrophe. I think they should listen to the experts. And, you know, the IEA is saying we can have no new oil and gas. The UN say it. The IPCC report says it. The World Bank say we need to act. The World Health Organization say we need to act. How many more experts need to say it before I can go back to a normal student life? But it's made me realise with my dad's that you can't always come to it from that point of view. And it's helped me meet people where they're at in their journey towards tackling the climate crisis. Because this is the biggest crisis that humanity has ever faced. And everybody has a part to play in fighting it. And of course not everybody will do the things that I do. I'm in no position to say that everybody should be going to prison or going out and getting arrested. Not everybody is willing or ready or able to take radical direct action, but everybody has a part to play. Whatever you can do, wherever you can do it, whenever you can do it, everybody has to do something. So speaking to my dad about it, who is about as far from my perception of it as anybody could be, we've been able to find the little common grounds that we can agree upon and start to build a relationship from there, recognising we have very different views, but we can both do something. And I've maybe been able to connect with him more on an emotional level about why I'm so scared, why I'm so outraged a lot of the time, than on a pure scientific basis.
Is the access to joy with your family any different now, having been to prison and having the climate crisis on your mind so much when it's seemingly not on theirs at all?
Yeah, it is. Quite often when maybe I see my family and we pretend that I haven't been to prison and this isn't one of the biggest parts of my life being involved in Just Stop Oil, feels like there's an elephant in the room that we've maybe been scared to address. And I've taken it upon myself now to start addressing it. I was scared to bring it up before because I knew they didn't approve in lots of ways. And now I know that we have to talk about it. And everybody needs to be having these difficult conversations with the people in their lives and the people they love, no matter what action you're taking on the climate crisis, if it's radical or if it's going vegan twice a week. We need to be having these difficult conversations about why we're doing it, because it's a really difficult thing to look at. Of course it is. You almost can't comprehend the scale of grief and severity that we're facing. We need to be having these conversations wherever and whenever we can be. And with my family, it's the hardest to reach that point. But I also think there's moments where they see not the Phoebe that goes on BBC to do interviews or goes to prison. They see the Phoebe that is a member of their family and that they love. They recognise that I'm still there and I do this maybe because of some of the things they love about me. They do this because I love and I care. And I think they're beginning to see that a bit more. Sorry. My alarm to sign in at Brixton Police Station. I still have to sign in twice a week. Oh, it's between 12 and 5. I set myself 3 alarms every Tuesday and Thursday so that I don't forget.
There's been an increasing number of young people signing up to Just Stop Oil. What would you say to the parents of these young people who are worried about their involvement? Maybe it's because they're locked into this idea that a criminal record will affect their future more than the climate crisis.
First, that I understand that it's a big thing when your child is going out, getting arrested, potentially going to prison. I think it's important to create that emotional space that obviously it is a stressful and scary thing. And I think I didn't do that with my parents initially because I was so set on the this is the morally right thing to do track. So that I understand that's not where you want your children to be. It is stressful, it is scary. The thing I asked my parents to do was to put themselves in my shoes, because when they were 21, they were looking at a very different world and a very different future to what I am. And I showed them some of what I think are the scariest predictions from the IPCC report. I told them, look, there's some predictions that say we run out of clean drinking water by 2040. I won't even be 40 then. And I said, look at the predictions they make for when we reach 3 degrees, which would be around the age that my parents are now. And then we see really catastrophic things. We see not just millions, but billions of climate refugees. We see vast swathes of the world becoming uninhabitable. We're already facing massive food shortages. 33% of our wheat crops failed this year. Half of our potato crops are predicted to fail. You know, that's already creating massive impacts on food scarcity. And by the time I reach my parents' age, actually, it's an if I reach my parents' age. And that's what I said to them. You know, my parents are in their early 60s and they still seem so young and fit and healthy to me. They seem like they've got loads of life ahead of them. And I'm terrified I won't make it to their age. And if I do, I dread to think what the world I live in will look like.
Could you help us to visualise the world that we are likely to experience without drastic change? Which aspect motivates you most to force the much needed change in society?
I think it's important when we talk about scientific predictions that, you know, it's not fact. We can't know, you know, by this year, this specific catastrophe will happen. There's a huge range of predictions and some of them are really catastrophic and really soon. And some of them don't predict the worst catastrophes till much later. And in these predictions, the thing that scares me most is food scarcity. And there's a whole range of knock-on effects. You know, we saw in COVID the kind of panic people went into when they couldn't buy toilet paper and people started hoarding things. How much worse do you think it's going to get when we can't grow crops? How much more inequality is going to come about? There's so many big risks that it's almost hard to comprehend. Like at 2 degrees of global warming, which they predict we reach sometime between 2040 and 2050, 2055-ish, again, giving leeway for predictions. So, you know, for me, I always bring that back to personally. That's when I'm between the ages of 40 and 50, roughly. And then they predict 1 billion climate refugees. That number's so big, I can't comprehend 1 billion people in my brain. So I like to bring it down to smaller things that I can comprehend. And this might sound really silly, but I think of when we had 40 degrees this summer, and I was out walking on Clapham Common, which I admit is not the height of beautiful nature, but I live right by Clapham Common. It was my little safe haven during lockdown. It was where I would go out to walk my dog. And I went during the extreme heat wave, and my dog was so hot she couldn't walk. And all the grass was brown and the leaves were falling down. And just a year before, it was where I'd been taking my dog and my partner out for picnics. And I looked around and I went, this isn't normal. And it's only going to get worse. And actually, a week after that point, I was smashing up petrol stations.
When people respond to the soup action, for example, the responses have been, oh, why don't you tackle the oil and gas industry? Why are you focusing on something that it hasn't contributed to the harm? But then you have done this as well, right? So can you explain what happened there?
Yeah, it's a comment I've had a lot, and one that is... The fact that people ask it shows why we have moved. We do also these cultural actions, because all of April, we went straight to the heart of the fossil fuel industry, and there were petrol shortages. I spoke to my mum about this, actually. I said, "Did you remember when there were petrol shortages in April?" She said, "Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do. Why was that?" I said, "Us." And barely anybody knew the name Just Stop Oil. Barely anybody knew that it was us doing it. Barely anybody knew our demand. No new fossil fuel licenses. Which is why in October we made the shift to go to the heart of power, to Westminster. Because what we are facing is not a scientific problem. It's a problem of political will. We have not all of them, but a lot of the scientific solutions needed to make a transition to a renewable and green future, but we don't have the political will. So that's why I threw soup on a painting, and it's insane to me that that's what it takes to get people talking about the climate crisis. But when me and Anna threw soup on a painting, it got that conversation going. More than 33 million people displaced by floods in Pakistan, or millions of people facing famine in East Africa. It shouldn't be what it takes. We're not going to stop. I think that's the main thing. I can't say what tactics we'll use in the future or where this movement will go. But what I do know for sure is that we can't be stopped. We're not going to be intimidated by harsher punishments or bullshit public order bills. We will keep on going. We will keep on fighting because there is so much at stake.
Music from Climate by Eric Ian Walker, commissioned by the Climate Music Project. We communicate the sense of urgency of the climate and ecological crises through the emotional power of music. More to be found at ericianwalker.bandcamp.com and climatemusic.org.